Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Welcome to God's Gumshoe Investigates the New Testament Bible. We're investigating the last days of Jesus. And as we did last week, we're going to begin with the academic or the scholar's perspective, and then take each of the biblical perspectives and compare it with the Urantia Book perspectives, our third witness or third voice in this case of the investigation of the New Testament Bible. We're bringing forth these three witnesses, the biblical perspective, the scholars or academic perspective, and the Urantia Book's perspective, as a comparison on the general truth about the New Testament Bible. We're doing so without comment. We're investigators. We're just merely bringing forth the facts. As Joe Friday used to say, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. You are the judge and the jury. Let's begin from the BBC's excellent episodes of The Hidden Miracles of Jesus, and then we'll continue on with the biblical perspective and the Urantia Book's examination of each event in these last days of Jesus' life on this planet. Planet Earth, or as the Urantia Book calls it, Planet Urantia. Let's have a listen.
Every Easter, pilgrims flock here to Jerusalem to retrace Jesus' final journey towards his death. They follow what's known as the Via Dolorosa, literally, the Way of Sorrows. It's traditionally believed to be the route along which Jesus carried the cross.
I first saw the Good Friday procession from this balcony 10 years ago, and I remember being amazed because it was not the kind of ritual that I associated with Christianity. It was fervent and it was very literal. The pilgrims were trying to identify with the agony that Jesus must have gone through.
But to get close to understanding what Jesus thought he was doing, we need to imagine the traditions and ideas that he grew up with and was shaped by. In fact, in Jewish scripture, there is a precedence for fighting evil through suffering. And very specifically, the idea of victory through death. It appears in a passage which Jesus would have heard read in the synagogue as a child. It was from the book of the prophet Isaiah in the Hebrew Bible, and it was all about a man who would undergo intolerable pain and hardship. He was known as the suffering servant.
We know from the Gospels that throughout Jesus' life, he quoted from this book of Isaiah, and there's a close similarity in their thinking. Both talk about the kingdom of God, and both stress suffering and rejection as a part of God's plan.
As Jesus carried the cross, it's likely that he identified himself with the suffering servant. Many scholars believe it's the only way to make sense of his behavior. He probably knew the many verses by heart and would have remembered them. He was despised and rejected by men. He was oppressed and he was afflicted. Yet he opened not his mouth, like a lamb that is led to the slaughter. Mark's gospel says that Jesus' final words were ones of despair. It's easy to dismiss Jesus' actions as those of a madman. But suppose he did believe he was God, could his death have made sense? If Jesus was convinced he was engaged in a battle against Satan, there was no more bitter symbol of his rule than the cross, the hated Romans' most brutal method of execution. By submitting to it, Jesus was literally throwing himself onto Satan and allowing him to do his worst. It fitted his teachings. The way to conquer evil was to renounce its weapons, to turn the other cheek, to be the suffering servant.
But in Isaiah, the suffering of the servant had a purpose. His humiliation was rewarded. God said, "I will give him a portion among the great."
And yet, as those closest to him watched him die, they must have believed he had failed. The Romans were still there. Nothing looked any different.
It seemed that Jesus had gambled and lost. All those miracles suggesting that he was God, he was the Messiah, the promised one, seemed to have come to nothing.
It was an unlikely end for someone who claimed to be God. Unless what the Gospels say happened next is true. That another miracle, the greatest of them all, was still to come. The death wasn't the end.
I'd like to thank Rege Omar, a well-known Middle East journalist and historian, who takes us through these pages of the book by Michael Simons called The Miracles of Jesus, and which forms a major part of a three-part BBC series called Hidden Meanings, The Miracles of Jesus. Now, we move on to the biblical aspect and the biblical perspectives of the episodes and the discussion around the destruction of Jerusalem. This takes place in the New Testament in Mark 13, Matthew 24, and Luke 21. And then we'll listen to the Urantia Book's perspective, and we'll begin to carry this story through these last days of Jesus' sojourn here on planet Earth, in Jerusalem, moving towards the crucifixion. Let's have a listen.
Chapter 124, Destruction of Jerusalem Foretold. Jesus went out from the temple for the last time. He would never return. As he was going by the temple building, one of his disciples came to Jesus and said, "Look at the majesty of these buildings. The stonework is marvelous and the adornments are spectacular." Jesus answered and said, "You see these buildings? The truth is that in the days to come, there will not be one stone left upon another. It will all be thrown down." Later, as Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives, on the side near the temple, the disciples Peter, James, John, and Andrew came to Jesus privately and said, "Teacher, tell us when these things will happen. What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the world?" And Jesus said, "Beware that no one leads you astray, for many will come using my name and will tell you that the time to set up the eternal kingdom has arrived. Do not follow after them. You will hear of wars and disturbances and rumors of wars. Do not let this trouble you or make you afraid. These things must happen before I come, but the end is not yet. Nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes all over the world, and all over the world there will be famines and pestilences, and there will be terror and great signs from heaven. All these are just the beginning birth pains. Before all these things happen, they will lay hands on you and persecute you. They will deliver you up to the synagogues and prisons and bring you before kings and governors for my namesake. They will deliver you up to councils and unto tribulation, and they will kill you. You will be beaten in the synagogues and hated of all nations for my namesake. You will stand before kings and give testimony for my namesake. And the gospel must first be preached to all nations. And when they lead you to judgment and deliver you up, do not be anxious ahead of time about what you will say. Settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on how to answer. I will give you a wise word to say that your adversaries will not be able to withstand. And whatever is given to you in that hour to say, you can say it. But it is not you that speaks, it is the Holy Spirit. Many will stumble and betray you and hate you, and many false prophets will rise and lead many astray. And because iniquity will come to its full fruition, the love of many will grow cold. Even parents will deliver up their own sons and daughters and friends, and brother will deliver up brother to death, and children will rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated of all men for my name's sake. But he that endures to the end will be saved. If you are patient, you will win your souls. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world for a testimony unto all the nations, and then the end will come. And when you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that her desolation is at hand. When you see the admonition of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, where he should not be, let him that reads this understand. Then let them that are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those that are in the middle of Jerusalem stay there. And if you're out in the countryside, do not enter into Jerusalem. Don't waste your time trying to collect your property or goods, for these are the days of vengeance, so that all that is written will be fulfilled. But woe unto them that are with child and those with small children, for there is going to be a great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. They will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles. Pray that your flight not be in winter, nor on the Sabbath. For on those days there will be a great tribulation such as there has never been since the beginning of the world. Unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, the ones God chose, he has shortened those days. And if any man says to you, 'Go here to see the Christ,' or 'Go there,' do not believe it. For there will arise many false Christs and false prophets, and they will show great signs and wonders, so as to lead the elect astray, if possible. Be warned ahead of time. I have told you all these things so that you will not be deceived. If they tell you, look, he is in the wilderness, do not go looking for him. Or look, he is in the inner chamber, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes out of the east and is seen in the west, so it will be with the coming of the Son of Man. Chapter 125, The Second Coming of Christ. But in those days the sun will become dark, and the moon will not give her light, and the stars will be shaken, and the powers of the heaven will be shaken. And there will be signs in the sun and moon and stars, and upon the earth distress of nations. There will be great agitation in the oceans, and men will be perplexed. Men will faint with fear because of things coming on the world, for the powers of the heaven will be shaken. And then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And then will they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with great power and glory. He will send out his angels with a great shout of the trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from everywhere in the universe. But when these things begin to come to pass, look up, lift your head, because your redemption is coming near. And he spoke a parable to them. Learn the parable of the fig tree. When her branches become tender and put forth leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things coming to pass, know that the kingdom of God is near, even knocking at the door. The truth you need to understand is this. This generation will not pass away until all things are fulfilled. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my word will not pass away. But the day this is going to happen, and the hour of the day, only the Father knows. When the Son of Man comes, it will be like the days of Noah. In those days they were eating and drinking and marrying until Noah entered into the ark. No one knew what was happening till a flood came and swept them all away. So it will be when the Son of Man comes. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other will be left behind. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. Watch with anticipation, because you do not know the day your Lord is going to come. If the head of the house knew when the thief was going to arrive, he would have been prepared for his coming and prevented his house from being broken into. Be ready, for his coming will be unexpected. Beware that you don't let your hearts become filled with the concerns and cares of this world, or become careless in how you live your life. The day will come like a net enclosing a covey of birds, and it will come on everyone. Blessed is the wise and faithful servant, whom his Lord will find doing his business when he comes. An evil servant says in his heart, my Lord is going to be late, and he begins to misuse his position and mistreat those under him, and lives an evil life full of self-indulgence. When the master does come, that servant will have his position and authority given to someone else, and he will go to where the hypocrites go. There will be gnashing of teeth and weeping without end. Watch and pray that you might escape all these things and stand before the Son of Man. Only the godly are able to stand in his presence. Watch and pray, for you do not know when the Lord is going to come. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of glory and gather the nations before him. He will separate them one from another, like a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on one side, and the goats on the other. Then the king will say to the ones on his right side, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when were you hungry and we fed you, or thirsty and we gave you drink? When did we see you as a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? The king answered, here is the truth that you really need to understand. Inasmuch as you did it to the least of my brothers, you did it to me. The king will say to the others on his left hand, Depart from me, you cursed, enter into the fire which is prepared for the devil and his angels. I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you didn't take me in. I was naked, and you didn't clothe me. I was sick, and you didn't visit me. I was in prison, and you didn't come to me. Here is the truth that you tragically missed. Inasmuch as you didn't do it to the least of my brothers, you didn't do it to me. The wicked will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous will go into eternal life.
Paper 176, Tuesday evening on Mount Olivet. This Tuesday afternoon, as Jesus and the apostles passed out of the temple on their way to the Gethsemane camp, Matthew, calling attention to the temple construction, said, Master, observe what manner of buildings these are. See the massive stones and the beautiful adornment. Can it be that these buildings are to be destroyed? As they went on toward Olivet, Jesus said, You see these stones and this massive temple. Verily, verily, I say to you, in the days soon to come, there shall not be left one stone upon another. They shall all be thrown down. These remarks, depicting the destruction of the sacred temple, aroused the curiosity of the apostles as they walked along behind the Master. They could conceive of no event, short of the end of the world, which would occasion the destruction of the temple. In order to avoid the crowds passing along the Kidron Valley toward Gethsemane, Jesus and his associates were minded to climb up the western slope of Olivet for a short distance, and then follow a trail over to their private camp near Gethsemane, located a short distance above the public camping ground. As they turned to leave the road leading on to Bethany, they observed the temple, glorified by the rays of the setting sun, and while they tarried on the mount, they saw the lights of the city appear, and beheld the beauty of the illuminated temple, and there, under the mellow light of the full moon, Jesus and the 12 sat down. The Master talked with them, and presently Nathanael asked this question, Tell us, Master, how shall we know when these events are about to come to pass? 1. The destruction of Jerusalem. In answering Nathanael's question, Jesus said, Yes, I will tell you about the times when this people shall have filled up the cup of their iniquity, when justice shall swiftly descend upon the city of our fathers. I am about to leave you. I go to the Father. After I leave you, take heed that no man deceive you, for many will come as deliverers, and will lead many astray. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, be not troubled, for though all these things will happen, the end of Jerusalem is not yet at hand. You should not be perturbed by famines or earthquakes, neither should you be concerned when you are delivered up to the civil authorities and are persecuted for the sake of the gospel. You will be thrown out of the synagogue and put in prison for my sake, and some of you will be killed. When you are brought up before governors and rulers, it shall be for a testimony of your faith and to show your steadfastness in the gospel of the kingdom. And when you stand before judges, be not anxious beforehand as to what you should say. For the Spirit will teach you in that very hour what you should answer your adversaries. In these days of travail, even your own kinsfolk, under the leadership of those who have rejected the Son of Man, will deliver you up to prison and death. For a time you may be hated by all men for my sake, but even in these persecutions I will not forsake you. My Spirit will not desert you. Be patient. Doubt not that this gospel of the kingdom will triumph over all enemies and, eventually, be proclaimed to all nations. Jesus paused while he looked down upon the city. The Master realized that the rejection of the spiritual concept of the Messiah, the determination to cling persistently and blindly to the material mission of the expected deliverer, would presently bring the Jews in direct conflict with the powerful Roman armies, and that such a contest could only result in the final and complete overthrow of the Jewish nation. When his people rejected his spiritual bestowal and refused to receive the light of heaven as it so mercifully shone upon them, they thereby sealed their doom as an independent people with a special spiritual mission on earth. Even the Jewish leaders subsequently recognized that it was this secular idea of the Messiah which directly led to the turbulence which eventually brought about their destruction. Since Jerusalem was to become the cradle of the early gospel movement, Jesus did not want its teachers and preachers to perish in the terrible overthrow of the Jewish people in connection with the destruction of Jerusalem. Wherefore did he give these instructions to his followers? Jesus was much concerned lest some of his disciples become involved in these soon coming revolts and so perish in the downfall of Jerusalem. Then Andrew inquired, "But Master, if the holy city and the temple are to be destroyed, and if you are not here to direct us, when should we forsake Jerusalem?" Said Jesus, "You may remain in the city after I have gone, even through these times of travail and bitter persecution. But when you finally see Jerusalem being encompassed by the Roman armies, after the revolt of the false prophets, then will you know that her desolation is at hand. Then must you flee to the mountains. Let none who are in the city and around about tarry to save aught, neither let those who are outside dare to enter therein. There will be great tribulation, for these will be the days of Gentile vengeance. And after you have deserted the city, this disobedient people will fall by the edge of the sword, and will be led captive into all nations. And so shall Jerusalem be trodden down by the Gentiles. In the meantime, I warn you, be not deceived. If any man comes to you saying, 'Behold, here is the deliverer,' or 'Behold, there is he,' believe it not, for many false teachers will arise, and many will be led astray. But you should not be deceived, for I have told you all this beforehand." The apostles sat in silence in the moonlight for a considerable time while these astounding predictions of the Master sank into their bewildered minds. And it was in conformity with this very warning that practically the entire group of believers and disciples fled from Jerusalem upon the first appearance of the Roman troops, finding a safe shelter in Pella to the north. Even after this explicit warning, many of Jesus' followers interpreted these predictions as referring to the changes which would obviously occur in Jerusalem when the reappearing of the Messiah would result in the establishment of the New Jerusalem and in the enlargement of the city to become the world's capital. In their minds, these Jews were determined to connect the destruction of the temple with the end of the world. They believed this New Jerusalem would fill all Palestine, that the end of the world would be followed by the immediate appearance of the new heavens and the new earth. And so it was not strange that Peter should say, "Master, we know that all things will pass away when the new heavens and the new earth appear, but how shall we know when you will return to bring all this about?" When Jesus heard this, he was thoughtful for some time and then said, "You ever err, since you always try to attach the new teaching to the old. You are determined to misunderstand all my teaching. You insist on interpreting the gospel in accordance with your established beliefs. Nevertheless, I will try to enlighten you." 2. The Master's Second Coming. On several occasions, Jesus had made statements which led his hearers to infer that, while he intended presently to leave this world, he would most certainly return to consummate the work of the heavenly kingdom. As the conviction grew on his followers that he was going to leave them, and after he had departed from this world, it was only natural for all believers to lay fast hold upon these promises to return. The doctrine of the second coming of Christ thus became early incorporated into the teachings of the Christians, and almost every subsequent generation of disciples has devoutly believed this truth and has confidently looked forward to his sometime coming. If they were to part with their master and teacher, how much more did these first disciples and the apostles grasp at this promise to return? And they lost no time in associating the predicted destruction of Jerusalem with this promised second coming. And they continued thus to interpret his words, notwithstanding that, throughout this evening of instruction on Mount Olivet, the Master took particular pains to prevent just such a mistake. In further answer to Peter's question, Jesus said, "Why do you still look for the Son of Man to sit upon the throne of David, and expect that the material dreams of the Jews will be fulfilled? Have I not told you all these years that my kingdom is not of this world? The things which you now look down upon are coming to an end, but this will be a new beginning out of which the gospel of the kingdom will go to all the world, and this salvation will spread to all peoples. And when the kingdom shall have come to its full fruition, be assured that the Father in heaven will not fail to visit you with an enlarged revelation of truth and an enhanced demonstration of righteousness. Even as he has already bestowed upon this world him who became the prince of darkness, and then Adam, who was followed by Melchizedek, and in these days the Son of Man. And so will my Father continue to manifest his mercy and show forth his love, even to this dark and evil world. So also will I, after my Father has invested me with all power and authority, continue to follow your fortunes and to guide in the affairs of the kingdom by the presence of my Spirit, who shall shortly be poured out upon all flesh. Even though I shall thus be present with you in spirit, I also promise that I will sometime return to this world, where I have lived this life in the flesh and achieved the experience of simultaneously revealing God to man and leading man to God. Very soon must I leave you and take up the work the Father has entrusted to my hands, but be of good courage, for I will sometime return. In the meantime, my Spirit of the truth of a universe shall comfort and guide you. You behold me now in weakness and in the flesh, but when I return it shall be with power and in the Spirit. The eye of flesh beholds the Son of Man in the flesh, but only the eye of the Spirit will behold the Son of Man glorified by the Father and appearing on earth in his own name. But the times of the reappearing of the Son of Man are known only in the councils of paradise. Not even the angels of heaven know when this will occur. However, you should understand that, when this gospel of the kingdom shall have been proclaimed to all the world for the salvation of all peoples, and when the fullness of the age has come to pass, the Father will send you another dispensational bestowal, or else the Son of Man will return to adjudge the age. And now, concerning the travail of Jerusalem, about which I have spoken to you, even this generation will not pass away until my words are fulfilled. But concerning the times of the coming again of the Son of Man, no one in heaven or on earth may presume to speak. But you should be wise regarding the ripening of an age. You should be alert to discern the signs of the times. You know when the fig tree shows its tender branches and puts forth its leaves that summer is near. Likewise, when the world has passed through the long winter of material-mindedness, and you discern the coming of the spiritual springtime of a new dispensation, you should know that the summertime of a new visitation draws near. But what is the significance of this teaching having to do with the coming of the sons of God? Do you not perceive that, when each of you is called to lay down his life struggle and pass through the portal of death, you stand in the immediate presence of judgment, and that you are face to face with the facts of a new dispensation of service in the eternal plan of the Infinite Father? What the whole world must face as a literal fact at the end of an age, you, as individuals, must each most certainly face as a personal experience when you reach the end of your natural life and thereby pass on to be confronted with the conditions and demands inherent in the next revelation of the eternal progression of the Father's kingdom. Of all the discourses which the Master gave his apostles, none ever became so confused in their minds as this one, given this Tuesday evening on the Mount of Olives, regarding the twofold subject of the destruction of Jerusalem and his own second coming. There was, therefore, little agreement between the subsequent written accounts based on the memories of what the Master said on this extraordinary occasion. Consequently, when the records were left blank concerning much that was said that Tuesday evening, there grew up many traditions, and very early in the second century, a Jewish apocalyptic about the Messiah, written by one Celta, who was attached to the court of the Emperor Caligula, was bodily copied into the Matthew Gospel and subsequently added, in part, to the Mark and Luke records. It was in these writings of Celta that the parable of the 10 virgins appeared. No part of the Gospel record ever suffered such confusing misconstruction as this evening's teaching, but the Apostle John never became thus confused. As these 13 men resumed their journey toward the camp, they were speechless and under great emotional tension. Judas had finally confirmed his decision to abandon his associates. It was a late hour when David Zebedee, John Mark, and a number of the leading disciples welcomed Jesus and the 12 to the new camp. But the apostles did not want to sleep. They wanted to know more about the destruction of Jerusalem, the Master's departure, and the end of the world. 3. Later discussion at the camp. As they gathered about the campfire, some 20 of them, Thomas asked, "Since you are to return to finish the work of the kingdom, what should be our attitude while you are away on the Father's business?" As Jesus looked them over by the firelight, he answered, "And even you, Thomas, fail to comprehend what I have been saying. Have I not all this time taught you that your connection with the kingdom is spiritual and individual, wholly a matter of personal experience in the Spirit by the faith realization that you are a son of God? What more shall I say? The downfall of nations, the crash of empires, the destruction of the unbelieving Jews, the end of an age, even the end of the world, what have these things to do with one who believes this gospel and who has hid his life in the surety of the eternal kingdom? You who are God-knowing and gospel-believing have already received the assurances of eternal life. Since your lives have been lived in the Spirit and for the Father, nothing can be of serious concern to you. Kingdom builders, the accredited citizens of the heavenly worlds, are not to be disturbed by temporal upheavals or perturbed by terrestrial cataclysms. What does it matter to you who believe this gospel of the kingdom if nations overturn, the age ends, or all things visible crash, since you know that your life is the gift of the Son and that it is eternally secure in the Father? Having lived the temporal life by faith and having yielded the fruits of the Spirit as the righteousness of loving service for your fellows, you can confidently look forward to the next step in the eternal career with the same survival faith that has carried you through your first and earthly adventure in sonship with God. Each generation of believers should carry on their work, in view of the possible return of the Son of Man, exactly as each individual believer carries forward his life work in view of inevitable and ever-impending natural death. When you have by faith once established yourself as a son of God, nothing else matters as regards the surety of survival. But make no mistake, this survival faith is a living faith, and it increasingly manifests the fruits of that divine spirit which first inspired it in the human heart. That you have once accepted sonship in the heavenly kingdom will not save you in the face of the knowing and persistent rejection of those truths which have to do with the progressive spiritual fruit-bearing of the sons of God in the flesh. You who have been with me in the Father's business on earth can even now desert the kingdom if you find that you love not the way of the Father's service for mankind. As individuals and as a generation of believers, hear me while I speak a parable. There was a certain great man who, before starting out on a long journey to another country, called all his trusted servants before him and delivered into their hands all his goods. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1. And so on down through the entire group of honored stewards, to each he entrusted his goods according to their several abilities. And then he set out on his journey. When their lord had departed, his servants set themselves at work to gain profits from the wealth entrusted to them. Immediately he who had received 5 talents began to trade with them, and very soon had made a profit of another 5 talents. In like manner, he who had received 2 talents soon had gained 2 more. And so did all of these servants make gains for their master, except he who received but 1 talent. He went away by himself and dug a hole in the earth, where he hid his lord's money. Presently the lord of those servants unexpectedly returned and called upon his stewards for a reckoning. And when they had all been called before their master, he who had received the 5 talents came forward with the money which had been entrusted to him and brought 5 additional talents, saying, "Lord, you gave me 5 talents to invest, and I am glad to present 5 other talents as my gain." And then his lord said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will now set you as steward over many. Enter forthwith into the joy of your lord." And then he who had received the 2 talents came forward, saying, "Lord, you delivered into my hands 2 talents. Behold, I have gained these other 2 talents. And his lord then said to him, "Well done, good and faithful steward. You also have been faithful over a few things, and I will now set you over many. enter you into the joy of your Lord. And then there came to the accounting he who had received the one talent. This servant came forward, saying, Lord, I knew you, and realized that you were a shrewd man, and that you expected gains where you had not personally labored. Therefore I was afraid to risk aught of that which was entrusted to me. I safely hid your talent in the earth. Here it is. You now have what belongs to you. But his Lord answered, You are an indolent and slothful steward. By your own words you confessed that you knew I would require of you an accounting with reasonable profit, such as your diligent fellow servants have this day rendered. Knowing this, you ought, therefore, to have at least put my money into the hands of the bankers, that on my return I might have received my own with interest. And then to the chief steward this Lord said, Take away this one talent from this unprofitable servant, and give it to him who has the 10 talents. To everyone who has, more shall be given, and he shall have an abundance. But from him who has not, even that which he has shall be taken away. You cannot stand still in the affairs of the eternal kingdom. My Father requires all his children to grow in grace and in a knowledge of the truth. You who know these truths must yield the increase of the fruits of the Spirit and manifest a growing devotion to the unselfish service of your fellow servants. And remember that, inasmuch as you minister to one of the least of my brethren, you have done this service to me. And so should you go about the work of the Father's business, now and henceforth, even forevermore. Carry on until I come. In faithfulness do that which is entrusted to you, and thereby shall you be ready for the reckoning call of death. And having thus lived for the glory of the Father and the satisfaction of the Son, you shall enter with joy and exceedingly great pleasure into the eternal service of the everlasting kingdom. Truth is living. The Spirit of Truth is ever leading the children of light into new realms of spiritual reality and divine service. You are not given truth to crystallize into settled, safe, and honored forms. Your revelation of truth must be so enhanced by passing through your personal experience that new beauty and actual spiritual gains will be disclosed to all who behold your spiritual fruits and in consequence thereof are led to glorify the Father who is in heaven. Only those faithful servants who thus grow in the knowledge of the truth and who thereby develop the capacity for divine appreciation of spiritual realities can ever hope to enter fully into the joy of their Lord. What a sorry sight for successive generations of the professed followers of Jesus to say, regarding our stewardship of divine truth, Here, Master, is the truth you committed to us 100 or 1,000 years ago. We have lost nothing. We have faithfully preserved all you gave us. We have allowed no changes to be made in that which you taught us. Here is the truth you gave us. But such a plea concerning spiritual indolence will not justify the barren steward of truth in the presence of the Master. In accordance with the truth committed to your hands, will the Master of Truth require a reckoning. In the next world, you will be asked to give an account of the endowments and stewardships of this world. Whether inherent talents are few or many, a just and merciful reckoning must be faced. If endowments are used only in selfish pursuits, and no thought is bestowed upon the higher duty of obtaining increased yield of the fruits of the Spirit, as they are manifested in the ever-expanding service of men and the worship of God, such selfish stewards must accept the consequences of their deliberate choosing. And how much, like all selfish mortals, was this unfaithful servant with a one talent, in that he blamed his slothfulness directly upon his Lord. How prone is man, when he is confronted with the failures of his own making, to put the blame upon others, oftentimes upon those who least deserve it. Said Jesus that night as they went to their rest, Freely have you received, therefore freely should you give of the truth of heaven. And in the giving will this truth multiply and show forth the increasing light of saving grace, even as you minister it. 4. The Return of Michael. Of all the Master's teachings, no one phase has been so misunderstood as his promise sometime to come back in person to this world. it is not strange that Michael should be interested in sometime returning to the planet whereon he experienced his seventh and last bestowal as a mortal of the realm. It is only natural to believe that Jesus of Nazareth, now sovereign ruler of a vast universe, would be interested in coming back, not only once but even many times, to the world whereon he lived such a unique life, and finally won for himself the Father's unlimited bestowal of universe power and authority. Urantia will eternally be one of the seven nativity spheres of Michael in the winning of universe sovereignty. Jesus did, on numerous occasions and to many individuals, declare his intention of returning to this world. As his followers awakened to the fact that their master was not going to function as a temporal deliverer, and as they listened to his predictions of the overthrow of Jerusalem and the downfall of the Jewish nation, they most naturally began to associate his promised return with these catastrophic events. But when the Roman armies leveled the walls of Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, and dispersed the Judean Jews, and still the Master did not reveal himself in power and glory, his followers began the formulation of that belief which eventually associated the second coming of Christ with the end of the age, even with the end of the world. Jesus promised to do two things after he had ascended to the Father, and after all power in heaven and on earth had been placed in his hands. He promised, first, to send into the world and in his stead another teacher, the Spirit of Truth, and this he did on the day of Pentecost. Second, he most certainly promised his followers that he would sometime personally return to this world, but he did not say how, where, or when he would revisit this planet of his bestowal experience in the flesh. On one occasion he intimated that, whereas the eye of flesh had beheld him when he lived here in the flesh, on his return, at least on one of his possible visits, he would be discerned only by the eye of spiritual faith. Many of us are inclined to believe that Jesus will return to Urantia many times during the ages to come. We do not have his specific promise to make these plural visits, but it seems most probable that he who carries among his universe titles that of Planetary Prince of Urantia will many times visit the world whose conquest conferred such a unique title upon him. We most positively believe that Michael will again come in person to Urantia, but we have not the slightest idea as to when or in what manner he may choose to come. Will his second advent on earth be timed to occur in connection with the terminal judgment of this present age, either with or without the associated appearance of a magisterial son? Will he come in connection with the termination of some subsequent Urantian age? Will he come unannounced and as an isolated event? We do not know. Only one thing we are certain of, that is, when he does return, all the world will likely know about it, for he must come as the supreme ruler of a universe and not as the obscure babe of Bethlehem. But if every eye is to behold him, and if only spiritual eyes are to discern his presence, then must his advent be long deferred. You would do well, therefore, to dissociate the Master's personal return to earth from any and all set events or settled epochs. We are sure of only one thing: he has promised to come back. We have no idea as to when he will fulfill this promise or in what connection. As far as we know, he may appear on earth any day, and he may not come until age after age has passed and been duly adjudicated by his associated sons of the Paradise Corps. The second advent of Michael on earth is an event of tremendous sentimental value to both midwayers and humans. But otherwise, it is of no immediate moment to midwayers and of no more practical importance to human beings than the common event of natural death, which so suddenly precipitates mortal man into the immediate grasp of that succession of universe events which leads directly to the presence of this same Jesus, the sovereign ruler of our universe. The children of light are all destined to see him, and it is of no serious concern whether we go to him or whether he should chance first to come to us. Be you therefore ever ready to welcome him on earth as he stands ready to welcome you in heaven. We confidently look for his glorious appearing, even for repeated comings, but we are wholly ignorant as to how, when, or in what connection he is destined to appear.
Now we pick the New Testament story up again with the betrayal of Judas, as told in Matthew chapter 26, verse 14, Mark 14, verses 10, and Luke 22, verses 3 to 6. Here, the value of the 30 pieces of silver is uncertain. Matthew's quotation refers to silver shekels, and at 4 denarii to a shekel, this would represent about 120 days' wages, so a significant amount. But let's have a listen. Let's pick the story up with the betrayal of Judas foretold. Here, the biblical perspective followed by the Urantia Book perspective. Let's have a listen.
Chapter 127. Judas bargains for Jesus' death. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "You know that in 2 days it will be Passover, and the Son of Man is going to be delivered up to be crucified." The chief priests and elders gathered together to hold court with the high priest Caiaphas. They began planning how they would arrest Jesus without creating a crisis with the people. And they planned how they would put him to death, but they feared the people. Satan entered into Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12 disciples. Judas went to meet with the chief priests and captains to discuss how he might deliver Jesus up to them. Judas asked, "What will you pay me to deliver Jesus up to you?" When the chief priests heard that Judas was willing to give up Jesus, they were glad. They agreed to pay Judas 30 pieces of silver. Judas agreed, and from that time on, he looked for the opportunity to deliver Jesus up in the absence of the crowds.
Four, Judas and the chief priests. Shortly after Jesus and John Mark left the camp, Judas Iscariot disappeared from among his brethren, not returning until late in the afternoon. This confused and discontented apostle, notwithstanding his master's specific request to refrain from entering Jerusalem, went in haste to keep his appointment with Jesus' enemies at the home of Caiaphas the high priest. This was an informal meeting of the Sanhedrin, which had been appointed for shortly after 10 o'clock that morning. This meeting was called to discuss the nature of the charges which should be lodged against Jesus and to decide upon the procedure to be employed in bringing him before the Roman authorities for the purpose of securing the necessary civil confirmation of the death sentence which they had already passed upon him. On the preceding day, Judas had disclosed to some of his relatives and to certain Sadducean friends of his father's family that he had reached the conclusion that, while Jesus was a well-meaning dreamer and idealist, he was not the expected deliverer of Israel. Judas stated that he would very much like to find some way of withdrawing gracefully from the whole movement. His friends flatteringly assured him that his withdrawal would be hailed by the Jewish rulers as a great event, and that nothing would be too good for him. They led him to believe that he would forthwith receive high honors from the Sanhedrin, and that he would at last be in a position to erase the stigma of his well-meant but unfortunate association with untaught Galileans. Judas could not quite believe that the mighty works of the Master had been wrought by the power of the Prince of Devils, but he was now fully convinced that Jesus would not exert his power in self-aggrandizement. He was at last convinced that Jesus would allow himself to be destroyed by the Jewish rulers, and he could not endure the humiliating thought of being identified with a movement of defeat. He refused to entertain the idea of apparent failure. He thoroughly understood the sturdy character of his master and the keenness of that majestic and merciful mind, yet he derived pleasure from even the partial entertainment of the suggestion of one of his relatives that Jesus, while he was a well-meaning fanatic, was probably not really sound of mind, that he had always appeared to be a strange and misunderstood person. And now, as never before, Judas found himself becoming strangely resentful that Jesus had never assigned him a position of greater honor. All along he had appreciated the honor of being the apostolic treasurer, but now he began to feel that he was not appreciated, that his abilities were unrecognized. He was suddenly overcome with indignation that Peter, James, and John should have been honored with close association with Jesus, and at this time, when he was on the way to the high priest's home, he was bent on getting even with Peter, James, and John more than he was concerned with any thought of betraying Jesus. But over and above all, just then, a new and dominating thought began to occupy the forefront of his conscious mind. He had set out to get honor for himself, and if this could be secured simultaneously with getting even with those who had contributed to the greatest disappointment of his life, all the better. He was seized with a terrible conspiracy of confusion, pride, desperation, and determination. And so it must be plain that it was not for money that Judas was then on his way to the home of Caiaphas to arrange for the betrayal of Jesus. As Judas approached the home of Caiaphas, he arrived at the final decision to abandon Jesus and his fellow apostles. And having thus made up his mind to desert the cause of the kingdom of heaven, he was determined to secure for himself as much as possible of that honor and glory which he had thought would sometime be his when he first identified himself with Jesus and the new gospel of the kingdom. All of the apostles once shared this ambition with Judas, but as time passed, they learned to admire truth and to love Jesus, at least more than did Judas. The traitor was presented to Caiaphas and the Jewish rulers by his cousin, who explained that Judas, having discovered his mistake in allowing himself to be misled by the subtle teaching of Jesus, had arrived at the place where he wished to make public and formal renunciation of his association with the Galilean, and at the same time to ask for reinstatement in the confidence and fellowship of his Judean brethren. This spokesman for Judas went on to explain that Judas recognized it would be best for the peace of Israel if Jesus should be taken into custody, and that, as evidence of his sorrow in having participated in such a movement of error, and as proof of his sincerity in now returning to the teachings of Moses, he had come to offer himself to the Sanhedrin as one who could so arrange with the captain holding the orders for Jesus' arrest that he could be taken into custody quietly, thus avoiding any danger of stirring up the multitudes or the necessity of postponing his arrest until after the Passover. When his cousin had finished speaking, he presented Judas, who, stepping forward near the high priest, said, "All that my cousin has promised, I will do. But what are you willing to give me for this service?" Judas did not seem to discern the look of disdain and even disgust that came over the face of the hard-hearted and vainglorious Caiaphas. His heart was too much set on self-glory and the craving for the satisfaction of self-exaltation. And then Caiaphas looked down upon the betrayer while he said, "Judas, you go to the captain of the guard and arrange with that officer to bring your master to us either tonight or tomorrow night, and when he has been delivered by you into our hands, you shall receive your reward for this service." When Judas heard this, he went forth from the presence of the chief priests and rulers, and took counsel with the captain of the temple guards as to the manner in which Jesus was to be apprehended. Judas knew that Jesus was then absent from the camp, and had no idea when he would return that evening. And so they agreed among themselves to arrest Jesus the next evening, Thursday, after the people of Jerusalem and all of the visiting pilgrims had retired for the night. Judas returned to his associates at the camp, intoxicated with thoughts of grandeur and glory such as he had not had for many a day. He had enlisted with Jesus, hoping some day to become a great man in the new kingdom. He at last realized that there was to be no new kingdom such as he had anticipated. But he rejoiced in being so sagacious as to trade off his disappointment in failing to achieve glory in an anticipated new kingdom for the immediate realization of honor and reward in the old order, which he now believed would survive, and which he was certain would destroy Jesus and all that he stood for. In its last motive of conscious intention, Judas's betrayal of Jesus was the cowardly act of a selfish deserter whose only thought was his own safety and glorification, no matter what might be the results of his conduct upon his master and upon his former associates. But it was ever just that way. Judas had long been engaged in this deliberate, persistent, selfish, and vengeful consciousness of progressively building up in his mind and entertaining in his heart these hateful and evil desires of revenge and disloyalty. Jesus loved and trusted Judas, even as he loved and trusted the other apostles, but Judas failed to develop loyal trust and to experience wholehearted love in return. And how dangerous ambition can be when it is once wholly wedded to self-seeking and supremely motivated by sullen and long-suppressed vengeance. What a crushing thing is disappointment in the lives of those foolish persons who, in fastening their gaze on the shadowy and evanescent allurements of time, become blinded to the higher and more real achievements of the everlasting attainments of the eternal worlds of divine values and true spiritual realities. Judas craved worldly honor in his mind and grew to love this desire with his whole heart. The other apostles likewise craved this same worldly honor in their minds, but with their hearts they loved Jesus and were doing their best to learn to love the truths which he taught them. Judas did not realize it at this time, but he had been a subconscious critic of Jesus ever since John the Baptist was beheaded by Herod. Deep down in his heart, Judas always resented the fact that Jesus did not save John. You should not forget that Judas had been a disciple of John before he became a follower of Jesus. And all these accumulations of human resentment and bitter disappointment, which Judas had laid by in his soul in habiliments of hate, were now well organized in his subconscious mind and ready to spring up to engulf him when he once dared to separate himself from the supporting influence of his brethren, while at the same time exposing himself to the clever insinuations and subtle ridicule of the enemies of Jesus. Every time Judas allowed his hopes to soar high and Jesus would do or say something to dash them to pieces, there was always left in Judas's heart a scar of bitter resentment. And as these scars multiplied, presently that heart, so often wounded, lost all real affection for the one who had inflicted this distasteful experience upon a well-intentioned but cowardly and self-centered personality. Judas did not realize it, but he was a coward. Accordingly, was he always inclined to assign to Jesus cowardice as the motive which led him so often to refuse to grasp for power or glory when they were apparently within his easy reach. And every mortal man knows full well how love, even when once genuine, can, through disappointment, jealousy, and long-continued resentment, be eventually turned into actual hate. At last the chief priests and elders could breathe easily for a few hours. They would not have to arrest Jesus in public, and the securing of Judas as a traitorous ally ensured that Jesus would not escape from their jurisdiction as he had so many times in the past.
Chapter 128, Preparation for Passover. The day of unleavened bread came. It was the day that the Passover lamb must be sacrificed. The disciples came to Jesus and said, "Where will we go to eat the Passover meal?" Jesus sent Peter and John to make ready the Passover meal. He said to them, "Go into the city, and when you have entered, you will meet a man that is carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house where he enters, and when they ask you, 'Why are you there?' tell them the teacher says, 'My time is at hand. Where will I eat the Passover with my disciples?' And he will show you a large upper room that is furnished and ready. Go to the upper room and make things ready for us." The disciples went into the city and found the man that Jesus described and made ready the Passover. When the evening came, Jesus and the 12 disciples came to the upper room. Jesus sat down with his 12 disciples. He said to them, "I desire to eat this Passover with you before I begin my suffering." And Jesus received the cup and gave thanks and said, "Take this cup and distribute it among yourselves. For I say to you, I will not drink from the fruit of the vine again until the kingdom shall come." And an argument started among them, which of them was going to be counted greatest, thinking that Jesus was just about to set up his earthly kingdom. Jesus said to them, "The kings and the Gentiles have lordship over others, and those that have authority over others are called benefactors. But it will not be that way with you. He that is greater among you, let him take the place of the youngest, and the one that is the chief among you, let him be the one that serves. Who is greater, the one that has served the meal, or the one that serves it? Is it not the one that sits at the meal? But I am in the midst of you as one who serves. You have continued with me in my trials, and I will have appointments for you in the kingdom, just as the Father has appointed me, that you may eat and drink at my table in the kingdom, and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." Chapter 129, The Passover Meal. Now before the feast of the Passover, Jesus knew that the hour had come that he should leave the world and go to his Father. Jesus loved his own that were in the world, and he loved them to the end. And during the supper, Jesus knew that Satan had already entered Judas Iscariot, and that he was plotting to betray him. Jesus rose up from the supper and laid his garment aside and put a towel around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that girded his waist. When he came to Peter, he asked, "Lord, "Are you planning to wash my feet?" Jesus answered him, "You do not understand what I am doing, but you will later." Peter said to Jesus, "You will never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash your feet, then you have nothing to do with me." Peter said to the Lord, "Then do not just wash my feet, wash my hands and my head also." Jesus said to Peter, "He that is bathed does not need anything washed but his feet, but is clean completely, and you are clean, but not all are clean." So Jesus washed their feet and then put his garment back on and returned to the table and sat with them. And then Jesus said to them, "Do you know what I have just done to you? You call me Lord and teacher, and just as I have washed your feet, you should also wash each other's feet. I have given you an example of how you are to treat each other, as I have done to you. I want to tell you an important truth that you really need to understand. I tell you that a servant is not greater than his Lord, nor is the one that is sent greater than the one who sent him. If you understand these things, then blessed are you when you do them. I do not speak to all of you. I know the ones I have chosen, but in order that the scriptures be fulfilled, he that eats my bread lifts up his heel against me. I am telling you this before it happens, so that you will believe that I am he when it does happen. The truth you really need to understand and pay attention to is that anyone who receives me also receives the one who sent me." Chapter 130, Judas's Betrayal Foretold. After Jesus said this, as he was eating, he became troubled in his spirit and testified, "Truly, truly, I tell you that one of you will betray me, someone who is eating with me right now." The disciples looked at one another, upset and wondering about who he was talking about. They became very agitated and sorrowful. Each one asked the Lord, "Is it me?" And he answered and said to them, "It is one of the 12. He that dips his hand in with me in the dish, the same is the one that will betray me. I am going to do what the Father has sent me to do, as it is written in Scripture. But woe to the man that betrays the Son of Man. It would be better if he had not been born." One of the disciples who was reclining on Jesus' bosom, who loved Jesus very much, Peter beckoned to him and told him to ask the Lord who it was that was going to betray him. And the disciple leaned back and asked the Lord who it was. Jesus answered, "It is the one I will dip the sop and give it to." So Jesus dipped the sop and gave it to Judas Iscariot. Judas answered the Lord and said, "Is it I, teacher?" Jesus said to him, "It is as you say." And Satan immediately entered Judas. And Jesus said to Judas, "Go quickly and do what you're going to do." Nobody knew what Jesus meant when he told Judas this, supposing Judas, who was in charge of the purse, was being sent on a mission to buy something needed for the rest of the feast. Judas went out into the night. After Judas was gone, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. Little children, I am going to be with you for a little while longer. You will seek me, but as I said to the Jews, you will not find me or be able to go where I am going. I give you a new commandment, that you love one another. Even as I have loved you, love each other. This is the way that men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Then Jesus said, "This night all will be offended in me, just as it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered abroad. But after I am raised up, I will go before you into Galilee." Simon Peter said to the Lord, "Wherever you go, I will follow you. I will lay down my life for you." Jesus answered Peter, "Will you lay down your life for me? Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has asked for you that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith does not fail. Here is what I want you to do. Once you have repented, establish your brothers." Peter protested, "Lord, I am ready to go to prison for you. I am willing to die for you. If all be offended in you, I will never be offended in you." Jesus said to Peter, "The truth you need to understand is that before the cock crows tomorrow morning, you will have betrayed me 3 times. Peter became agitated and vehemently said that even if he would die, he would never deny him. The other disciples joined in. Jesus said to them, "When I sent you out without purse and without wallet or shoes, did you lack for anything?" They answered, "Nothing." And he said to them, But now he that has money, let him take it and sell it and buy a sword. For I say to you that what is written will be fulfilled in me. And he was reckoning with the transgressors, for those things concerning me are being fulfilled. And they said, Lord, we have two swords. Is that enough? Chapter 131, The Lord's Supper Instituted. As they were eating, the Lord, on the same night that he was betrayed, took the bread, and after he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples and said, Take, eat. This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And he took the cup in like manner after the supper, and he gave thanks and said to them, Drink all of it, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many, for the remission of sins, even the blood that is poured out for you. Do this in remembrance of me as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup. You proclaim the Lord's death until he comes again. But I will not drink any more of the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink anew in my Father's kingdom. And they all drank of it.
Paper 179, The Last Supper. During the afternoon of this Thursday, when Philip reminded the Master about the approaching Passover and inquired concerning his plans for its celebration, he had in mind the Passover supper which was due to be eaten on the evening of the next day, Friday. It was the custom to begin the preparations for the celebration of the Passover not later than noon of the preceding day, and since the Jews reckoned the day as beginning at sunset, this meant that Saturday's Passover supper would be eaten on Friday night, sometime before the midnight hour. The apostles were, therefore, entirely at a loss to understand the Master's announcement that they would celebrate the Passover one day early. They thought, at least some of them did, that he knew he would be placed under arrest before the time of the Passover supper on Friday night, and was therefore calling them together for a special supper on this Thursday evening. Others thought that this was merely a special occasion which was to precede the regular Passover celebration. The apostles knew that Jesus had celebrated other Passovers without the lamb. They knew that he did not personally participate in any sacrificial service of the Jewish system. He had many times partaken of the paschal lamb as a guest, but always, when he was the host, no lamb was served. It would not have been a great surprise to the apostles to have seen the lamb omitted even on Passover night, and since this supper was given one day earlier, they thought nothing of its absence. After receiving the greetings of welcome extended by the father and mother of John Mark, the apostles went immediately to the upper chamber, while Jesus lingered behind to talk with the Mark family. It had been understood beforehand that the Master was to celebrate this occasion alone with his 12 apostles. Therefore, no servants were provided to wait upon them. 1. The Desire for Preference. When the apostles had been shown upstairs by John Mark, they beheld a large and commodious chamber which was completely furnished for the supper, and observed that the bread, wine, water, and herbs were all in readiness on one end of the table. Except for the end on which rested the bread and wine, this long table was surrounded by 13 reclining couches, just such as would be provided for the celebration of the Passover in a well-to-do Jewish household. As the 12 entered this upper chamber, they noticed, just inside the door, the pitchers of water, the basins, and towels for laving their dusty feet. And since no servant had been provided to render this service, the apostles began to look at one another as soon as John Mark had left them. And each began to think within himself, Who shall wash our feet? And each likewise thought that it would not be he who would thus seem to act as the servant of the others. As they stood there, debating in their hearts, they surveyed the seating arrangement of the table, taking note of the higher divan of the host, with one couch on the right and 11 arranged around the table on up to opposite this second seat of honor on the host's right. They expected the Master to arrive any moment, but they were in a quandary as to whether they should seat themselves or await his coming and depend on him to assign them their places. While they hesitated, Judas stepped over to the seat of honor, at the left of the host, and signified that he intended there to recline as the preferred guest. This act of Judas immediately stirred up a heated dispute among the other apostles. Judas had no sooner seized the seat of honor than John Zebedee laid claim to the next preferred seat, the one on the right of the host. Simon Peter was so enraged at this assumption of choice positions by Judas and John that, as the other angry apostles looked on, he marched clear around the table and took his place on the lowest couch, the end of the seating order and just opposite to that chosen by John Zebedee. Since others had seized the high seats, Peter thought to choose the lowest, and he did this not merely in protest against the unseemly pride of his brethren, but with the hope that Jesus, when he should come and see him in the place of least honor, would call him up to a higher one, thus displacing one who had presumed to honor himself. With the highest and lowest positions thus occupied, the rest of the apostles chose places, some near Judas and some near Peter, until all were located. They were seated about the U-shaped table on these reclining divans in the following order. On the right of the Master, John. On the left, Judas, Simon Zelotes, Matthew, James Zebedee, Andrew, the Alpheus twins, Philip, Nathanael, Thomas, and Simon Peter. They are gathered together to celebrate, at least in spirit, an institution which antedated even Moses and referred to the times when their fathers were slaves in Egypt. This supper is their last rendezvous with Jesus, and even in such a solemn setting, under the leadership of Judas, the apostles are led once more to give way to their old predilection for honor, preference, and personal exaltation. They were still engaged in voicing angry recriminations when the Master appeared in the doorway, where he hesitated a moment as a look of disappointment slowly crept over his face. Without comment, he went to his place, and he did not disturb their seating arrangement. They were now ready to begin the supper, except that their feet were still unwashed, and they were in anything but a pleasant frame of mind. When the Master arrived, they were still engaged in making uncomplimentary remarks about one another, to say nothing of the thoughts of some who had sufficient emotional control to refrain from publicly expressing their feelings. 2. Beginning the supper. For a few moments after the Master had gone to his place, not a word was spoken. Jesus looked them all over and, relieving the tension with a smile, said, "I have greatly desired to eat this Passover with you. I wanted to eat with you once more before I suffered, and realizing that my hour has come, I arranged to have this supper with you tonight, for as concerns the morrow, we are all in the hands of the Father whose will I have come to execute. I shall not again eat with you until you sit down with me in the kingdom which my Father will give me when I have finished that for which he sent me into this world." After the wine and the water had been mixed, they brought the cup to Jesus, who, when he had received it from the hand of Thaddeus, held it while he offered thanks. And when he had finished offering thanks, he said, "Take this cup and divide it among yourselves, and, when you partake of it, realize that I shall not again drink with you the fruit of the vine, since this is our last supper. When we sit down again in this manner, it will be in the kingdom to come." Jesus began thus to talk to his apostles because he knew that his hour had come. He understood that the time had come when he was to return to the Father, and that his work on earth was almost finished. The Master knew he had revealed the Father's love on earth, and that he had shown forth his mercy to mankind, and that he had completed that for which he came into the world, even to the receiving of all power and authority in heaven and on earth. Likewise, he knew Judas Iscariot had fully made up his mind to deliver him that night into the hands of his enemies. He fully realized that this traitorous betrayal was the work of Judas, but that it also pleased Lucifer, Satan, and Caligastia, the prince of darkness. But he feared none of those who sought his spiritual overthrow, any more than he feared those who sought to accomplish his physical death. The Master had but one anxiety, and that was for the safety and salvation of his chosen followers. And so, with the full knowledge that the Father had put all things under his authority, the Master now prepared to enact the parable of brotherly love. 3. Washing the Apostles' Feet. After drinking the first cup of the Passover, it was the Jewish custom for the host to arise from the table and wash his hands. Later on in the meal, and after the second cup, all of the guests likewise rose up and washed their hands. Since the apostles knew that their master never observed these rites of ceremonial hand-washing, they were very curious to know what he intended to do when, after they had partaken of this first cup, he arose from the table and silently made his way over to near the door where the water pitchers, basins, and towels had been placed. And their curiosity grew into astonishment as they saw the master remove his outer garment, gird himself with a towel, and begin to pour water into one of the foot basins. Imagine the amazement of these 12 men who had so recently refused to wash one another's feet, and who had engaged in such unseemly disputes about positions of honor at the table, when they saw him make his way around the unoccupied end of the table to the lowest seat of the feast, where Simon Peter reclined, and, kneeling down in the attitude of a servant, made ready to wash Simon's feet. As the master knelt, all 12 arose as one man to their feet. Even the traitorous Judas so far forgot his infamy for a moment as to arise with his fellow apostles in this expression of surprise, respect, and utter amazement. There stood Simon Peter, looking down into the upturned face of his master. Jesus said nothing. It was not necessary that he should speak. His attitude plainly revealed that he was minded to wash Simon Peter's feet. Notwithstanding his frailties of the flesh, Peter loved the Master. This Galilean fisherman was the first human being wholeheartedly to believe in the divinity of Jesus, and to make full and public confession of that belief. And Peter had never since really doubted the divine nature of the Master. Since Peter so revered and honored Jesus in his heart, it was not strange that his soul resented the thought of Jesus kneeling there before him in the attitude of a menial servant and proposing to wash his feet as would a slave. When Peter presently collected his wits sufficiently to address the Master, he spoke the heart feelings of all his fellow apostles. After a few moments of this great embarrassment, Peter said, "Master, do you really mean to wash my feet?" And then, looking up into Peter's face, Jesus said, "You may not fully understand what I am about to do, but hereafter you will know the meaning of all these things." Then Simon Peter, drawing a long breath, said, "Master, you shall never wash my feet." And each of the apostles nodded their approval of Peter's firm declaration of refusal to allow Jesus thus to humble himself before them. The dramatic appeal of this unusual scene at first touched the heart of even Judas Iscariot. But when his vainglorious intellect passed judgment upon the spectacle, he concluded that this gesture of humility was just one more episode which conclusively proved that Jesus would never qualify as Israel's deliverer, and that he had made no mistake in the decision to desert the Master's cause. As they all stood there in breathless amazement, Jesus said, "Peter, I declare that, if I do not wash your feet, you will have no part with me in that which I am about to perform." When Peter heard this declaration, coupled with the fact that Jesus continued kneeling there at his feet, he made one of those decisions of blind acquiescence in compliance with the wish of one whom he respected and loved. As it began to dawn on Simon Peter that there was attached to this proposed enactment of service some signification that determined one's future connection with the Master's work, he not only became reconciled to the thought of allowing Jesus to wash his feet, but, in his characteristic and impetuous manner, said, "Then, Master, wash not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." As the Master made ready to begin washing Peter's feet, he said, "He who is already clean needs only to have his feet washed. You who sit with me tonight are clean, but not all. But the dust of your feet should have been washed away before you sat down at meat with me. And besides, I would perform this service for you as a parable to illustrate the meaning of a new commandment which I will presently give you." In like manner, the Master went around the table in silence, washing the feet of his 12 apostles, not even passing by Judas. When Jesus had finished washing the feet of the 12, he donned his cloak, returned to his place as host, and after looking over his bewildered apostles, said, "Do you really understand what I have done to you? You call me Master, and you say, 'Well, for so I am.' If then the Master has washed your feet, why was it that you were unwilling to wash one another's feet? What lesson should you learn from this parable in which the Master so willingly does that service which his brethren were unwilling to do for one another? Verily, verily, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, neither is one who is sent greater than he who sends him. You have seen the way of service in my life among you, and blessed are you who will have the gracious courage so to serve. But why are you so slow to learn that the secret of greatness in the spiritual kingdom is not like the methods of power in the material world? When I came into this chamber tonight, you were not content proudly to refuse to wash one another's feet, but you must also fall to disputing among yourselves as to who should have the places of honor at my table. Such honors the Pharisees and the children of this world seek, but it should not be so among the ambassadors of the heavenly kingdom. Do you not know that there can be no place of preferment at my table? Do you not understand that I love each of you as I do the others? Do you not know that the place nearest me, as men regard such honors, can mean nothing concerning your standing in the kingdom of heaven? You know that the kings of the Gentiles have lordship over their subjects, while those who exercise this authority are sometimes called benefactors. But it shall not be so in the kingdom of heaven. He who would be great among you, let him become as the younger, while he who would be chief, let him become as one who serves. Who is the greater, he who sits at meat, or he who serves? Is it not commonly regarded that he who sits at meat is the greater? But you will observe that I am among you as one who serves. If you are willing to become fellow servants with me in doing the Father's will, in the kingdom to come you shall sit with me in power, still doing the Father's will in future glory. When Jesus had finished speaking, the Alpheus twins brought on the bread and wine, with the bitter herbs and the paste of dried fruits, for the next course of the Last Supper. 4. Last Words to the Betrayer. For some minutes the apostles ate in silence, but under the influence of the Master's cheerful demeanor, they were soon drawn into conversation. And ere long the meal was proceeding as if nothing out of the ordinary had occurred to interfere with the good cheer and social accord of this extraordinary occasion. After some time had elapsed, in about the middle of this second course of the meal, Jesus, looking over them, said, I have told you how much I desired to have this supper with you, and knowing how the evil forces of darkness have conspired to bring about the death of the Son of Man, I determined to eat this supper with you in this secret chamber, and a day in advance of the Passover, since I will not be with you by this time tomorrow night. I have repeatedly told you that I must return to the Father. Now has my hour come, but it was not required that one of you should betray me into the hands of my enemies. When the 12 heard this, having already been robbed of much of their self-assertiveness and self-confidence by the parable of the feet washing and the Master's subsequent discourse, they began to look at one another, while in disconcerted tones they hesitatingly inquired, Is it I? And when they had all so inquired, Jesus said, While it is necessary that I go to the Father, it was not required that one of you should become a traitor to fulfill the Father's will. This is the coming to fruit of the concealed evil in the heart of one who failed to love the truth with his whole soul. How deceitful is the intellectual pride that precedes the spiritual downfall! My friend of many years, who even now eats my bread, will be willing to betray me, even as he now dips his hand with me in the dish. And when Jesus had thus spoken, they all began again to ask, Is it I? And as Judas, sitting on the left of his master, again asked, Is it I? Jesus, dipping the bread in the dish of herbs, handed it to Judas, saying, You have said. But the others did not hear Jesus speak to Judas. John, who reclined on Jesus' right hand, leaned over and asked the Master, Who is it? We should know who it is that has proved untrue to his trust. Jesus answered, Already have I told you, even he to whom I gave the sop. But it was so natural for the host to give a sop to the one who sat next to him on the left that none of them took notice of this, even though the Master had so plainly spoken. But Judas was painfully conscious of the meaning of the Master's words associated with his act, and he became fearful lest his brethren were likewise now aware that he was the betrayer. Peter was highly excited by what had been said, and leaning forward over the table, he addressed John, Ask him who it is, or if he has told you, tell me who is the betrayer. Jesus brought their whisperings to an end by saying, I sorrow that this evil should have come to pass, and hoped even up to this hour that the power of truth might triumph over the deceptions of evil. But such victories are not won without the faith of the sincere love of truth. I would not have told you these things at this, our Last Supper, but I desire to warn you of these sorrows, and so prepare you for what is now upon us. I have told you of this because I desire that you should recall, after I have gone, that I knew about all these evil plottings, and that I forewarned you of my betrayal. And I do all this only that you may be strengthened for the temptations and trials which are just ahead." When Jesus had thus spoken, leaning over toward Judas, he said, "What you have decided to do, do quickly." And when Judas heard these words, he arose from the table and hastily left the room, going out into the night to do what he had set his mind to accomplish. When the other apostles saw Judas hasten off after Jesus had spoken to him, they thought he had gone to procure something additional for the supper, or to do some other errand for the master, since they supposed he still carried the bag. Jesus now knew that nothing could be done to keep Judas from turning traitor. He started with 12, now he had 11. He chose 6 of these apostles, and though Judas was among those nominated by his first chosen apostles, still the master accepted him and had, up to this very hour, done everything possible to sanctify and save him, even as he had wrought for the peace and salvation of the others. This supper, with its tender episodes and softening touches, was Jesus' last appeal to the deserting Judas, but it was of no avail. Warning, even when administered in the most tactful manner and conveyed in the most kindly spirit, as a rule, only intensifies hatred and fires the evil determination to carry out to the full one's own selfish projects when love is once really dead. 5. Establishing the Remembrance Supper. As they brought Jesus the third cup of wine, the cup of blessing, he arose from the couch and, taking the cup in his hands, blessed it, saying, "Take this cup, all of you, and drink it. This shall be the cup of my remembrance. This is the cup of the blessing of a new dispensation of grace and truth. This shall be to you the emblem of the bestowal and ministry of the divine spirit of truth. And I will not again drink this cup with you until I drink in new form with you in the Father's eternal kingdom." The apostles all sensed that something out of the ordinary was transpiring as they drank this cup of blessing in profound reverence and perfect silence. The old Passover commemorated the emergence of their fathers from a state of racial slavery into individual freedom. Now the Master was instituting a new remembrance supper as a symbol of the new dispensation wherein the enslaved individual emerges from the bondage of ceremonialism and selfishness into the spiritual joy of the brotherhood and fellowship of the liberated faith sons of the living God. When they had finished drinking this new cup of remembrance, the Master took up the bread and, after giving thanks, broke it in pieces and, directing them to pass it around, said, "Take this bread of remembrance and eat it. I have told you that I am the bread of life, and this bread of life is the united life of the Father and the Son in one gift. The word of the Father, as revealed in the Son, is indeed the bread of life." When they had partaken of the bread of remembrance, the symbol of the living word of truth incarnated in the likeness of mortal flesh, they all sat down. In instituting this remembrance supper, the Master, as was always his habit, resorted to parables and symbols. He employed symbols because he wanted to teach certain great spiritual truths in such a manner as to make it difficult for his successors to attach precise interpretations and definite meanings to his words. In this way he sought to prevent successive generations from crystallizing his teaching and binding down his spiritual meanings by the dead chains of tradition and dogma. In the establishment of the only ceremony or sacrament associated with his whole life mission, Jesus took great pains to suggest his meanings rather than to commit himself to precise definitions. He did not wish to destroy the individual's concept of divine communion by establishing a precise form. Neither did he desire to limit the believer's spiritual imagination by formally cramping it. He rather sought to set man's reborn soul free upon the joyous wings of a new and living spiritual liberty. Notwithstanding the Master's effort thus to establish this new sacrament of the remembrance, those who followed after him in the intervening centuries saw to it that his expressed desire was effectively thwarted, in that his simple spiritual symbolism of that last night in the flesh has been reduced to precise interpretations and subjected to the almost mathematical precision of a set formula. Of all Jesus' teachings, none have become more tradition standardized. This supper of remembrance, when it is partaken of by those who are son-believing and God-knowing, does not need to have associated with its symbolism any of man's puerile misinterpretations regarding the meaning of the divine presence. For upon all such occasions, the Master is really present. The remembrance supper is the believer's symbolic rendezvous with Michael. When you become thus spirit-conscious, the Son is actually present, and his spirit fraternizes with the indwelling fragment of his Father. After they had engaged in meditation for a few moments, Jesus continued speaking, "When you do these things, recall the life I have lived on earth among you, and rejoice that I am to continue to live on earth with you and to serve through you. As individuals, contend not among yourselves as to who shall be greatest. Be you all as brethren. And when the kingdom grows to embrace large groups of believers, likewise should you refrain from contending for greatness or seeking preferment between such groups." And this mighty occasion took place in the upper chamber of a friend. There was nothing of sacred form or of ceremonial consecration about either the supper or the building. The remembrance supper was established without ecclesiastical sanction. When Jesus had thus established the supper of the remembrance, he said to the apostles, "And as often as you do this, do it in remembrance of me. And when you do remember me, first look back upon my life in the flesh, recall that I was once with you, and then by faith discern that you shall all sometime sup with me in the Father's eternal kingdom. This is the new Passover which I leave with you, even the memory of my bestowal life, the word of eternal truth, and of my love for you, the outpouring of my spirit of truth upon all flesh." And they ended this celebration of the old but bloodless Passover in connection with the inauguration of the new supper of the remembrance by singing, all together, the 118th Psalm.
So here we are. It's Thursday night. The apostles are celebrating their last meal with Jesus, the Last Supper. Join us next week as we join this event and listen to the final teachings and the final discourse of Jesus, and then as they move to Gethsemane. We'd like to thank the BBC, the Urantia Book Fellowship, and the Bible Heritage Foundation for giving us permission to use this material. Join us next week as we continue with this investigation into the last week of Jesus' life in the flesh here on our planet. Thank you. See you next week.